Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. And remind him about that it appears in the Etet Ne'eman every week also, the following week, a transcript of our discussion.
You're right. I should
mention. Very illuminating.
It is illuminating, and you're right. I don't cite them enough. The Etet Ne'eman, in its English edition, which, of course, is distributed far and wide, but specifically to a lot of folks in the New York and New Jersey area, features a transcript of our conversation. So, for instance, today's conversation, assuming it's a good and enlightening one, will be printed in next week's paper, and we thank the folks at the Etet for that, and I appreciate you reminding me. And speaking of reminders, a reminder about an appearance you're making tomorrow night, is it?
Yes, at Beth Torah on Ocean Parkway, I think at 8 p.m.
Have you chosen a topic?
They have chosen a topic, yes.
And do you know what it is, or you forgot already what the topic is?
It will be relevant to the Inyune de Yoma, as we say. It will be about the current developments and issues.
Oh, in other words, the biggest news stories of the week.
Not of the week. But
so obviously,
stories, and especially now of 2012.
Right, and obviously, if that's
and if there's time at the end, I'll tell them who the next president will be.
Oh, wow. That's a teaser.
If there's time.
But if you're talking about the biggest and most important stories, obviously you're going to be speaking about those Hasidic reggae superstars who have shaven over the last few days, I would guess.
And who have decided that they are no longer what they were, right?
It must drive you crazy when the news media focuses on certain things and totally ignores life and death situations, you know?
When you see this week, as we did with Tom Friedman, this is how people can totally distort reality. Icons of our era, as they are portrayed, citing other icons of the era who are just off-the-wall critics. And, you know, it's no different than if Chomsky or Walton Mearsheimer could have written that column as much as Tom Friedman, and yet he's still held in such esteem by too many.
All right, so what is the explanation? I know that, we're not here to psychoanalyze people, but, I mean, Friedman is somebody you're very familiar with, and many of us as readers are familiar with for decades at this point. And we hate throwing around, you know, terms like self-hating Jews and anti-Semitism and everything else, but what is the motivation behind this? Why does it always seem like he's always pushing the envelope?
Well, again, we don't want to go into psychoanalysis here, and I'm not equipped to do that or licensed, so I won't. But there's clearly something very wrong with him. I mean, to go to the extreme and to talk about the fact that the only reason Bibi got the standing applause that he did 30 times interrupted my members of Congress is somehow because of the nefarious lobby.
Right.
He must have read Walter Mearsheimer. Maybe he wrote it. I don't know. But he certainly read it, bought the Kool-Aid. And just this outrageous assumptions, and I suggest to people to read the Jerusalem Post editorial in today's paper, where you will get some very good responses. But, you know, just look at who he quotes. I mean, he quotes Gideon Levy, who is such a radical extremist writer in Haaretz, which in and of itself hasn't produced an honest story in a long time, and uses this as evidence to justify his assertions and his readiness to criticize and to attack Netanyahu. And, you know, you can criticize his policy is one thing. This goes far beyond it. And his misunderstanding also of the events in the Middle East. I mean, this is the guy who carried the water for the Saudis on the, remember when the king's plan that he still seems to be addicted to.
Understood.
Other than that, I liked it.
And in terms of the Netanyahu reaction in Washington, it seems like it's almost wrong for the United States to have an ally. It seems like it's wrong for the United States government and its officials to actually embrace a friend, and that there can't be a legitimate reason outside of some, you know, back room or backward deal. Or backwards thinking that's, you know, going on in the nation's capital.
Well, I mean, you also see it in the criticism when the Republican candidates saying good things about Israel,
right,
and where they take strong stands, right away they come under criticism, including from, unfortunately, some Jewish sources. And, you know, it's pandering if it's not the candidate you like. And that's one. Two, why don't people come to the understanding that the U.S. military has, that this is our one ally? Look at the events from Egypt to Morocco, we have Islamist regimes coming into power of various kinds, and the instability that dominates. And we know we have one stable place where we can pre-position $1.5 billion in equipment and know that it'll be there for American troops should they need it. The joint efforts on the missile defense system, the technology that Israel has helped provide, and at a time when we see ourselves being threatened, the Iranians say they're going to do a military drill to close the Straits of Tehran, through which 40% of the oil coming to the West passes every day. Probably one of the most strategic waterways in the world. They have a very excellent Navy. It is one of the capacities that they really developed, the Iran Revolutionary Guard, beyond the regular Navy. And you look at one threat after another, and you say, look, in this picture, you take the whole Middle East, where's the one island of stability, regardless of all of the instability that exists, you know, the political question stuff, and where are you sure that there will be a democracy there no matter what?
Right. By the way, is there a call to action on this? Have people told you that they're writing to Thomas Friedman or to the Times, or has there been any formal, a method that has been distributed about how to respond to all this?
Well, I think people should respond, as I always do, and I think this is such a blatant and clear call for people to at least express themselves and let it be known how they feel about it. But this is, it was so over the top, and I can't give you the bottom line explanation for what has happened to him, but I hope that that people will at least now put into context what he writes in the future.
When Newt Gingrich gets up and talks about and defends his statement about the Palestinians being an invented people, I assume that that's one of the things you were referring to, when talking about candidates who, quote-unquote, according to some, are pandering and others have legitimate positions. Do you think that do things like this hurt a guy like Gingrich? And secondarily, is it better for Israel if he doesn't go ahead and use these euphemisms when it comes to the Palestinians?
Well, it's not really a euphemism. I mean, there is a validity to what he's asserting. The question is, should he assert it, and does it confuse people, or people reject then the rest of the message because it's not something they can accept? They see the reality, and they say, well, I know that they exist. So for him to say that they didn't exist, and because people don't know the history, and, they've been hammered with this message,
right.
So he had a valid points to make. I think your second question is smart. Does it really help or hurt? But I don't think that's what they were referring to. And the pandering was just when people talked about Romney said one of the first places he would visit.
Right.
Gingrich talked about moving the embassy. Other things that make absolutely rational policy. You know, every presidential election we have candidates who promise it, and then when they get into office, they face realities, and they, while their intentions may be good, the actions don't necessarily correlate to what they promise. But you want people who start off with a bottom line, with a policy, with an attitude, with an understanding of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And I think it's ridiculous when people, either they're embarrassed by the fact that candidates talk about Israel. I don't want it to be a partisan issue. I don't want it to be a divisive issue. We see in Congress the importance of Republicans, Democrats standing up and working together in support of Israel, and it's reflected in every vote. But I think that the fact that people want to say that they're pro-Israel and feel that it's an important thing to do, and they do it not just in front of Jewish audiences, it sometimes baffles me.
Do you suspect that because of the current economic situation in the United States, that again, as we saw a few years ago, that the Obama-Republican debate, for instance, will probably not include much when it comes to foreign policy, Iran, and of course Israel?
We've had so many Republican debates, they had to get to foreign policy.
No, but I'm talking about Obama versus the Republicans.
But I do believe the election will be much more about domestic affairs, unless, things heat up with Iran, or unless we see, further deterioration in other circumstances, which we are seeing. I mean, we see now the issue becoming, how did the United States react to the downing of the drone,
right.
The U.S. surveillance drone, which we spoke about. It's a stealth drone, highly sophisticated. Were they able to, as they claim, to break into the GPS guidance system and, in fact, land the plane, meaning the Iranians, the Iranian technicians who have been working on this for a long time? They claim now that they have a couple of Israeli and several American drones. I don't know how many, but they do have some. This one is more sophisticated, and the concern that they've already shown it to the Russians and show it to others. compromises some of the technology, perhaps, in it. But, you know, so events happen that become then fodder and then get a broader explanation or application as to whether this is reflective of how the United States does foreign policy today.
I have to ask you a question about technology in a second. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. We're doing the weekly update with Malcolm Honlein. You know, you mentioned technology, and this thought came to my mind this week. You know, there has been a discovery of businesses helping Hezbollah through the banking system, correct?
There was. This is actually a very interesting case because it involved the sale of used cars from the United States, purchased here, through the Lebanese Canadian Bank, which is based in Lebanon, but it has a presence here in the United States, and two money exchange companies. They bought and shipped used cars from the U.S. to West Africa, where the cars were sold, and then the money smuggled into Lebanon for Hezbollah. So they had money couriers who were carrying and doing this. Remember, we've had it in the past, cigarette sales here in this country. We've had other, you know, these sometimes what might seem like petty crime actually involves huge sums of money. Here they're talking about $300 million or $250 million, depending upon which estimate you see. But that case was just broken in the last few days.
So it's the extra steps that make it difficult for law enforcement agencies to catch up with these guys? I mean, you know, I would think technologically at this point, you know, if somebody makes a withdrawal thousands of miles away from their bank, you know, the government knows about it within seconds. It's hard to put two and two together because of these extra steps.
That is one of the things that banks are required now to look at, because KYC and the Know Your Customer requirements is to look if there are unusual transfers, and banks do it every day, all day. Sometimes it's very hard to prove. I mean, you could have people who have sent money back to family in the Middle East or elsewhere, and there could be special circumstances, whatever, that require them to have larger amounts. But yes, it is a requirement, and the difficulty is that you have this system in the Muslim world where people lay out money abroad and it's paid back here, and these are not recorded necessarily or reported transactions. Here, you know how many cars are stolen and shipped abroad, or cars are legitimately purchased and then shipped abroad, and there you have a very hard time checking where the track of the money, what happens to it if the car is sold.
Right, so it's that extra step. It's that extra step that's most difficult for them, trying to track the money, the one that
as opposed to a direct transfer.
Right, the cash that's going with the courier to the terrorist groups. Right, it's the cash that's going with the courier to the terrorist groups.
Right.
Yeah. This week, Susan Rice, and this is a statement that actually came from your office, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, denounced the treatment that Israel receives at the U.N. as, quote, obsessive, ugly, bad for the United Nations, and bad for peace. And I know you don't think so, but was it a risk that maybe Susan Rice was going a little bit overboard with this language?
No, I don't think so at all. I think it's an apt description, and it's something that U.S. ambassadors come to realize, that the accusations, their steady stream, the charges, we're going to see a new one coming out of the European Union now, where they're going to target Israel's treatment of its Arab minorities. Arabs and minority groups throughout the Middle East are being persecuted, prosecuted, killed, and the EU doesn't bother with it. In Israel, where they have a right to serve in the Knesset, where they have rights far beyond any other minority in the Middle East, then they become then the target of this distorted and unjustifiable kind of criticism. And we see it in so many realms. By the way, even now with UNRWA, something that we've complained about, the UN Relief Works Agency, Holland, which is the sixth biggest donor, I think $30 million a year, is reconsidering its support, as did Canada already, because of this definition of refugees and because they kept third-generation refugees, Palestinian refugees, and, you know, that the definitions don't comport with anything else. Yet that gets almost no criticism. Israel constantly, and that's what Ambassador Rice...
Any specific event that precipitated this, or just coincidence that it's happening this week, that she makes a statement like this week?
No, she was at an event that we had, and she... laid out U.S. policy and her perspective of what was happening at the U.N., talked about the unilateral declaration and the steps that are taken often against Israel there.
In Gaza, you know, there have been more rockets this week. I mean, I'm sure you know there have been more rockets this week, and Israel, of course, has retaliated, as we reiterated last week. That's their new policy. They go right in if, in fact, southern Israel is attacked. Is there going to be a point soon that the prime ministers are going to have to decide on a full-scale military operation?
How soon it will be is a question. It's not something Israel wants to do for a variety of reasons. One, because of the toll it takes. Two, because of the Egyptian government and sensitivity, especially as they're in elections. As you know, yesterday was the second round of elections that took place in a number of rural areas, as well as in parts of in Giza, which is a part of Cairo, and the Nile Delta regions. And we'll know the results, I think, by tomorrow, latest by Sunday. And we'll see if there's any backlash to the tremendous showing that the Muslim Brotherhood made, and even more so the Salafis, getting better than about a quarter of the vote for the parliament, which will be responsible to appoint the assembly of about 100 people that is supposed to write the constitution and define the powers of the president, et cetera, et cetera. So you have another round of elections there.
I forget, they're allies of the Muslim Brotherhood or not?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood now is being seen as the more moderate compared to the Salafis, who are more extreme, but they're really part of the same spectrum. And together they have 61% of the first round of voting, reminds us about what the trend is and the delicacy of the situation of the generals, who are still the source of stability. And to a degree, Israel is conditioning its responses so as not to upset further the situation there. Also, they want to see more action in Sinai, where you have Al-Qaeda, Iran, the Bedouin, and Hamas, of course, working together. Hamas marked its 24th anniversary this week and proudly proclaimed that they killed 1,365 Israelis and documented, and this is really quite remarkable that it didn't get more attention, because they document the fact that the Al-Qassam brigades, which are the ones that carry out the attack supposedly, that they say they had 1,848 of their fighters were killed in the process of their killing, that they fired 11,093 rockets and carried out 1,117 attacks against Israelis, including 87 suicide bombings.
Wow.
So when Israel says that 12,000 rockets were fired, here you have Hamas giving a specific count. And when people say, it's haphazard, they don't know, look at this report coming from them to put the lie to that.
Yeah, always believe the enemy, and in this case, there's no reason not to.
That is right.
The Shalit deal concludes in the next couple of days, right? In terms of the
release is taking place now, and this is...
is this making...
There are no Hamas guys in this one. These are more petty criminals who were in Israeli jails.
And so, therefore, I would guess it's not really making waves in Israel, or am I wrong about that?
This one did not make big waves, and I guess once they publish the list of the specific names, we'll find out. But as I said, if they're petty criminals, this is not going to cause the reaction.
Gilad Shalit addressed the Israeli public this week, or at least spoke to the press. Is this going to be something that's commonplace for him, or this will be few and far between?
Well, so far, this is the first one he did, and I think he did it as a tape so as to avoid, and he made a public appearance with it, but they taped it to put it out, so that he doesn't have to. I'm sure he's still in the recovery mode, and I hope that the time will come when he'll come to the United States, too.
He may come to the U.S.?
It's actually an interesting thing. One of the studies shows how identification with him and why personalizing Israel, not just talking about Israel, but talking about Israelis, and how people identified with him even beyond those who identify with Israel.
It could end up being there could end up being a very positive angle to that.
Yes. I mean, it's unfortunate that the price that had to be
right, obviously, right,
happened to him. But, yes, you're right. And you know, it's coming at a time when there's such a flux of these charges. And, you know, they don't look at what happens in Syria. The Arab League comes with these half-hearted solutions and the threats of the threats to create a humanitarian corridor or free zones and et cetera. In the meantime, 5,000 people have been killed. The weapons coming in to Syria from the north, from Turkey and Iraq, and the south from Lebanon, the Hums attack and the free army, as they call it, of Syria, more and more defectors coming in, raising the tally on all of this, people selling their jewelry in order to buy weapons
wow.
to defend themselves. You know, that this is an incredibly complex and difficult situation. Russia and China stand up for them, and Iran as well, with Hezbollah, defend Assad, who still seems to be living in a never-never land, not believing that the people are doing this, but that it's a CIA plot together with the Mossad to bring him down. And the way that this is being played, and the failure to understand the significance of it, and what is at stake if Assad falls. Where's the planning for what happens in the next stage? And I think that the West ought to be talking about protecting the minorities and other things so that you encourage them. We see that he and his brother Maher, who's considered even a more hard line, have really taken control, and they are apparently detached from reality.
But protect them in what way? I mean, we saw the price of the war in Iraq, and we know that, you know...
Well, we created those safe zones, if you remember, for refugees. And we've done it in other places to try and protect them. But here you have the Arab League and the others who should be taking responsibility for this.
It's like, yes. I mean, it's unrealistic in many ways.
It's unlikely.
They are unlikely.
Yeah. It's not unrealistic. I mean, they along the border, if they're willing to, I mean, obviously there would be clashes, and the Syrian army is not going to just sit down and take it, probably. But he can't stretch his forces too far because it's only the Fourth Army that's fighting, which is under his brother's control. And they need to be in Hama and Homs, and we're expecting a big attack in the next days there to put down this incipient revolution. And there are areas of the city that are actually controlled by the Syrian Free Army.
So Syria is in civil war, or you wouldn't use that term?
Well, it's in a mini-civil war, as I said all along. When you see Damascus and Aleppo up in arms, you know that that's the beginning of the end, or the end of the end. This is, there's a lot of speculation about what his future could be, but as long as he has Iran behind him, and Iran has its own problems. We saw this week the blast at the steel factory, another explosion, and it's believed it may be a place where North Koreans were training Iranians Maraging steel, which is used for the centrifuges for the enrichment of uranium or for a missile, for the exhaust on missiles, and it's one of a series of these attacks. But the most interesting story was that in that last attack, if you remember, that we discussed when the head of their missile program was killed in the beginning of November or early November, and 17 people were killed, it turns out now that that Khamenei was invited to be there. And didn't go. And now he has arrested a bunch of Iran Revolutionary Guards people, including his own son, because they believe it was an assassination attempt, that it was meant to kill him.
Wow.
I mean, it's really unbelievable, these stories. And again, as I said, the focus on the drone sometimes obscures the real stories that are happening. I mean, you have a claim that the clerics said they're going to shoot 150,000 missiles on Israel, that you have military maneuvers to close the Strait of Hormuz. They have a meeting in Saudi Arabia, which I think is very important, between the Crown Prince, Nayef, who's the real power today, and the Iranian Minister of Intelligence. And they talked about Iraq. They talked about other situations, which are of great concern to Saudi Arabia, particularly the withdrawal from Iraq of American troops and Iran's efforts to penetrate. By the way, Iraqi Shiites this week came out and said they don't want Iran. The Shiites that should have been their natural allies in Iran tell them they don't want them to be there, that they know enough of what Iran's domination would mean for them. But this Saudi meeting, I think, is very important. And whether it was an attempt to coordinate, or more likely, I think, for them to put down markers about their concerns about what is happening, because the feeling is that if Assad lasts, that Iran and Syria and the others will turn their attention towards the Gulf, which has long been, and Saudi Arabia, which have long been their primary targets. So you have such a spate of activity going on right now.
But what does turn their attention to Saudi Arabia mean? What does that mean? They're not attacking Saudi Arabia, are they?
Of course They want the oil in Saudi Arabia. The eastern province has a big Shiite population that the Iranians have been stirring up all along. There are a lot of demonstrations. The Saudi army puts it down, except there's no press there. That was why they went after Bahrain. Iran tried to overthrow the government of Bahrain, which is a Sunni government ruling a Shiite majority. And when the Saudis sent in the troops, even the United States criticized rather than applauding it, because that's what saved Saudi Arabia.
When is the last time Saudi Arabia was in a war?
In Yemen, they fought Iran, but they're proxy wars, really. They fight, you know, in other people's wars. They themselves didn't come under direct attack.
So it's
along the Yemeni border, you had the Houthis acting for Iran and for the al-Qaeda operating across the border against them.
So it is possible, then, if in fact there is established some, if in fact some stability is established in Syria, that Syria and or Iran will attack Saudi Arabia.
Will continue their undermining efforts and stir up the population and carry out attacks either through proxies or directly. You know, they have the capacity. Iran has a strong army, has a strong navy.
I mean, in a case like that, the U.S. would be viewed as an ally of Saudis.
Absolutely. The United States would have vested interest. But we see, you know, we were an ally of Mubarak, too. And we don't know whether this all that happened there in the rest of the Middle East will not come to visit the Gulf also. And they, of course, are very concerned and taking steps by liberalizing some things, although, you know, still restricting women and others. I think the best indication is we see Iranians who fear war are obtaining visas to move abroad and changing their money into foreign currencies.
Not at a quick enough pace, right?
Pardon me?
Not at a quick enough pace. Not enough. Those who were concerned about that they should leave, they're not doing so at a quick enough pace.
Well, the Jews are not leaving at a quick enough pace. I'm talking here about the general population.
Yeah, I understand that. But
looking at the situation and thinking about what the future holds, and also the economy has been badly hurt. We know that they officially now say that inflation went from 8.8 to 20%. Now, that's what they admit, which means that we believe it was closer to 30% before, so you can imagine what it really is.
In Iran.
In Iran, right. And with the increased sanctions, the House this week passed a very tough sanctions bill, including the sanction against the Iran Central Bank, which the administration has opposed because they're feared about the price of oil and other things. But the vote was very strong. It was like 410 to 11 or 411 to 10. In the House, and the Senate has a similar bill, but it probably won't take it up until the next
session.
The next session.
Boy, traveling with you through the Middle East on Friday is exhausting. This is I'll tell you, I got a headache from this trip. This is crazy. It's unbelievable. By the way, a lot of people furious at Bibi for changing the rules of the Likud primary, specifically moving it way up to just about a month from now.
Well, they voted on it. He proposed it, but the Likud Central Committee.
Come on, if Bibi wants it.
Why? This is a democracy, you know. That couldn't have happened.
If Bibi wants it, it happens. And now, of course, it gives other candidates who thought that they'd have an opportunity to move into the higher slots in the Likud much less time to campaign and get their whole thing going. Seems a little bit suspicious, no?
No, I think it's he would like to get it in the thing because you have elections coming up in 2013. He's right now very strong, and a smart politician moves when they're strong. Too often, and especially, I think, true of Likud guys, they always wait to hold elections when it was too late. Shamir was always criticized for that. And so he's smart to take advantage of it. Now the pressure is on Tzipi Livni to approve Kadima having earlier primaries, and there's a lot of challenges to her leadership, especially for Mofaz, but others as well. And she's resisting it so that, you know, you have reasons to go both ways, but especially the time when you have a lot of political instability, people tend to avoid it if it challenges their leadership. If it strengthens their leadership, political leaders go with it.
You know what's funny? I spoke recently with some people who voted for Livni. It seems that those voters are most disappointed in their candidate compared to Barack and Netanyahu. The Livni people are pretty disappointed in her. Are you getting that feeling as well?
Well, Barack today doesn't have much of any people.
Well, there are people who voted for him.
There were people who voted for him, and they were disappointed. That's why he doesn't have the Labor Party anymore. He's not the head of what was once the Labor Party. You know, he broke off, and
right.
He has, you know, and in the polls, he certainly doesn't make the threshold to have a party. Livni also is not that popular within Kadima, and that's why you have the challenges to her leadership. People have raised real concerns about some of the remarks that she made, even during recent visits to the United States. So she's been very controversial, and there is a real question as to whether she can hold on to the leadership of the party in if there are primary, and there certainly will be one, I think, in 2012 with the election scheduled for 2013 anyway. Netanyahu may move it up a little bit, but we have to see. Events, I think, will dictate more, and the polls than the calendar.
Right. Finally, Malcolm, these price tag attacks and the folks who are living in Judea and Samaria who are taking matters into their own hands and attacking mosques and IDF bases, etc. Obviously, nobody approves of this type of reaction to things, but it seems that the Israeli government is not cooperating with them the way they would like. What do you think is going to happen in this situation?
There is no justification. There's no rationalizing attacks on the Israeli forces or burning mosques or anything else of that kind. There is no justification, and there are people who try to rationalize it and justify it. You can disagree with policies. You can certainly disagree with when the synagogue is taken down or something else happens. There are legitimate ways to give expression to it. These Hilltop kids are a tragedy. It's a tragedy for them because they're ruining their lives. How it came about and all of that are subjects we can discuss, and certainly there's criticism for many, including the government, about how circumstances developed. But I hear people, especially this week, you know, who were saying, well, you have to understand, and it's justified and sort of welcome these price tags. It's taking a heavy toll in public opinion. It's not something you can rationalize in a democracy. And I think the prime minister and the government were right that they will crack down in any way to prevent and to arrest those responsible, and no one should be encouraging that. You can disagree, you can attack, and there's plenty of reason to be critical of this or any other government here or in Israel, but you've got to think about how you give expression to that.
All right. Malcolm, tomorrow night on Ocean Parkway, Bet Torah it is?
Yes, Bet Torah.
And next week we'll do your Hanukkah message because I got to run now. So
Syrian to attend.
Wish you a happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
And a good Shabbos.